KUOW podcasts are made possible by listener support. Become a new or renewing member today at KUOW.org.
From KUOW 94.9 Seattle, I'm Rachel Solomon. This is Speakers Forum. In a way, Majora Carter's dog is partially responsible for the existence of a Bronx park. More than a decade ago, Carter was pulled by her dog into a vacant, trashed lot and onto the banks of the Bronx River. After securing a USDA Forest Service Program grant, Carter worked with community groups over 5 years to build the award-winning Hunts Point Riverside Park. Carter is an urban revitalization strategist who examines the connection between urbanization and the environment. She spoke at the University of Washington's Kane Hall on January 22nd as part of the Graduate School Lecture Series.
Hello, hello, hello. Thank you so much for having me. It is good to be in the County of Kings. And if I didn't say, you know, this is the week we commemorated as a country Dr. King's legacy, celebrating on Monday. And I don't think it's a coincidence, since I don't believe in coincidence, that I'm here at this time. Because I've spent, you know, most of my life, or my professional life anyway, trying to figure out how do you make the lives of people who live in communities better. And I think when we think of Dr. King's legacy, so much of that was focused on, you know, he was, you know, a fighter for racial equality. But there was so much more to it. You know, obviously, you know, where was he when he was killed? You know, he was down in Memphis, Tennessee, fighting on behalf, you know, black sanitation workers, you know, right for economic and environmental equality, as they did some of the worst, most dangerous, most least paying jobs, you know, within sanitation as well. And of course, you know, his work in the Poor People's Movement and as an anti-Vietnam, you know, advocate, a war advocate. But really, I think at the essence of what his work was, it was really all about how do you make people's lives better? How do you help them, you know, create the kind of infrastructure that helps people to live their lives and gloriously and have it more abundantly? You know, not necessarily just surviving, but really thriving and doing it in a way where life is just something that makes, that feels worth living. And all of that, I think today, when I think about that, it just inspires me to think, like, this is why I do what I do. And this is why I think many of you here do what you do as well. So what I want to do with you today is actually go take you through some of my process and through my work. Because one of the things that's been really frustrating about being me is that when I do presentations, what I get from people afterward is this really, it's beautiful and loving, and I'm one lucky woman. You know, I hear from people how inspiring the work is, and that's great, and I appreciate that. But then what I also hear from them is things like, but I could never do anything like that. I'm just one person. And I had to, that makes me feel bad, because I feel that when people are not, when they're self-censoring themselves and not giving themselves an opportunity to look at themselves as creators of change, I think we all suffer when we don't allow ourselves to do that. So what I've been doing lately is actually helping people go through the process and literally giving folks my secret sauce. I actually teach workshops on this. And it's you know, helping people take an idea to reality. And I'm going to show you how I've done this with each of my projects and what I'm doing now, and hopefully you can apply it to all your work as well. So what do you first do when you've got an idea? You know, and you think it's a great idea. You first have to check and just make sure it's meeting a need, a market need, whether or a policy need, something out there that your big idea has to, you know, somebody's got to want it, right? The next thing you have to do is design an attractive solution. And, you know, not just a solution that you think is cool because you think everybody should be wearing purple belts for whatever reason. No, maybe they need white ones. Who knows? It doesn't make any difference. But the point is, it's got to be an attractive solution and not just to you. Then you have to look for angel investment. And angel investment can come in the form of both either money, but sometimes it can come in the form of a very influential person or group of people who can sort of anoint your project as something worth following. And then you launch a beta version with whatever resources you have. It has to be something that manifests your idea into the world so that folks can actually respond to it. And then you don't just sit back on your haunches and go, look at my fabulous creation. You actually have to watch how people use it, how they take it in or don't take it in, and you refine your model as you go along. And that's when you reiterate and you expand on it. And so for me, with as we started this work, I came into this work in this very strange way. I was actually, you know, I am a great product of a liberal arts education. You know, I have no background in urban planning or environmental science or studies or anything like that. I went back home to the community I was born and raised in, the one that I had worked my butt off to leave because I didn't want to be associated with the poster child for urban blight anymore. Came back home because I was broke and had and was going to graduate school, and my parents was the cheapest place I could find. Period. That was it. But got very involved in this struggle that was happening in the local community, which was that our city and state had deemed our community that already had a lot of environmental issues going on there with the fact that they wanted to build another waste facility on our waterfront. And I was like, this is so crazy. And I got involved in that particular fight, which was awesome. But it became really clear to me that as much as I knew we needed to be fighting and advocating, you know, against some really crappy, totally unsustainable solid waste management plans, what was not feeding me was my desire to want to fight for something. Like, what did we need in our community? And so one of the things I realized, because I'd heard it from people within the community, was that they wanted places, safe places for their kids to play. They wanted parks, places that they would then leave the community in order to have their kids experience, or just a place to relax, whatever, but they wanted parks. And so I thought, oh, okay, so that if that's a need within the community, what is the attractive solution? So this wasn't exactly it, but this was a dead-end street on the waterfront. The only reason why I knew it was a dead-end street on the waterfront was because my dog pulled me into this the street that had been used as a dump for decades. And so it seemed to me that designing an attractive solution on this site, which actually dead-ended at the Bronx River, so that we could have a waterfront park, could be an attractive solution to that problem. And then that what came as a form of angel investment was a little $10,000 seed grant that I applied for through the U.S. Forest Service that was interested in doing Bronx River restoration projects, or rather in particular, river projects in underserved communities. And I just thought, okay, great. If that's not us, I don't know what is. So we did things like cleanups. I was able to talk to different types of groups, whether they were large or small businesses within the community who donated services. You know, it helped me become a liaison between the city and other groups like that. And we did all of these types of ways to just sort of bring attention to the site and, of course, to clean it up as well. And our beta version came like this was it. You know, nothing major. You know, we planted weeping willows because they grow really quickly. They're practically weeds. But the whole point is that it just provided a completely different clean slate for it. But we realized, since we did not have the culture within the community to that was a part of going to parks, that most of the time they would be empty because there was no programming in them. So we realized we had to get programming into the parks so that people would use them. And so we learned from that, and we brought in groups that worked on, that built boats, that did environmental restoration, that did canoe rides on the water, just to get people connected to that resource that was there. And it was an incredibly, you know, smart move on our part, because not only did it help the city, did it help the people in the local community see this as a real important part of the community, but because people in the community thought it was very important, thus we got the attention of the city. And we were able to get a $3 million allocation in order to completely redesign that park. This is one of my favorite pictures in the world, because I'm clearly just posing for this picture, because I'm just like, I did all the work already. Take my picture. And the rest of the guys are doing the work. And I'm like, you know, about time you take over. But anywho, they kind of did. So $3 million later, our little beta version went from that to this. And this is the Hunts Point Riverside Park, you know, actually literally the day after they finished the first round of plantings. And it's since become this incredible place for the local community to be a part of and to see themselves reflected in. So building that model out was also the place that I got married in. That is the puppy that dragged me into the park, Zena, who was my flower girl. And it really was just a tremendous way to say, hello, we're here, we're beautiful in the community, and this is Zena with the National Award for Excellence in Urban Design, the Rudy Bruner Award that we won as well, with Zena with her well-earned reward. So, and going back to the whole idea of this secret sauce, what were some other market needs that we had? Safer streets in terms of traffic calming. You know, when the streets were designed in our community, it really was often done not at the expense of the people that live there, but it was definitely designed, you know, as a place where industry trumped people. And so really working with that was really difficult. Diabetes and obesity in our local community, it's something that just around the country, but if we think about the fact that the levels of physical activity, lack of, and not even going to talk about the food desert issue, but just levels of people not getting physical activity was something, another market need that we have to deal with simply because of the effect on people's health and what that costs them and the community. Stormwater management, another huge issue. And as the climate continues to change and we're just dealing with more increased storms going forward, and what do we do, you know, in the drier periods? How do we manage stormwater more effectively and also use that as an opportunity through green infrastructure to this is gray infrastructure here, but, you know, this kind of stuff has no other added benefits in terms of helping to cool, you know, the air, providing vegetated surfaces to do so. I mean, this is very single-use kind of thing, so stormwater management is also a really big thing. These are single-use, ugly, expensive, and stinky. So greenways was this thing that I heard of, you know, happening in Copenhagen and places like Bogota, Colombia, and that were dedicated bike and pedestrian paths, and, you know, if done well, they could serve as they were green, so they could provide opportunities for stormwater management. They could be pretty, so maybe it'd make people want to be outside more, getting, you know, energy and walks out there. You know, and also their traffic calming, just naturally, because they often provided just barriers, you know, within the street that forced vehicles to slow down. So it was just like, huh, this is interesting. So the attractive solution was building the greenway, and the seed money came in the form of a $1.25 million federal transportation proposal that I wrote that provided us with the funds to do the design and feasibility study for it, you know, which was a pretty massive undertaking for a whole 11-mile network of greenways. And so the idea here was that this was our beta version. All we really were, I mean, because people were getting killed by speeding traffic going up these streets within the local area, coming up from the industrial area. So just doing these medians was a big deal for us to slow traffic down. And then, you know, because they were cute, we put in a couple street trees. But the idea here was that there could be a whole lot more. And then this became a stormwater management tool as well, and developing, you know, great places for just the community to sort of see as they walked by or ran by, you know, hopefully even more so. And developing, you know, again, the traffic calming thing was very, very, very smart, and even thinking about this as an economic development corridor, is just having things look more pretty is much more physically, aesthetically pleasing to folks. And greenways, of course, are just linear parks. So the hours, even though it's an 11-mile network, that's a little skinny little thing. But this is one of my favorite pieces because it physically will connect us once we build this bridge over 25 feet of water. It'll connect us to one of the largest parks in the city, which is a 400-acre park called Randall's Island. So this will happen next year, or be done by next year. And another very serious market need that we had in our local communities was jobs. You know, I'm from one of the poorest congressional districts in the country. We have our unemployment rate hovers somewhere around 27%. And so to provide getting a real opportunity for people to feel both a personal and a financial stake in some of the improvements that were happening in the local community around the environment was important for the longevity of both the work and for the people themselves. So that job creation around green projects was very, very important. So the attractive solution was creating a program that trained people, and then we created the infrastructure so that we could place them into jobs as well. So instead of the city bringing in folks and importing them to do this ecological restoration work, we started a program to make sure that they would be the ones hired to do that work. So everything, so in terms of the ecological restoration piece, of course, started with wetland restoration because we were working on the Bronx River, so that had to be dealt with. And then later on, urban forestry management, green roof installation, was also another very important thing that we worked on as well. And specifically, doing it with the populations that we worked on, our beta version was a very expensive project. We spent about $23,000, you know, per head to get a person through our 5-month-long program, which was crazy for a job training program. It was just way too expensive. And it also meant that we couldn't afford to train many people. We learned from that model, cut out everything that was unnecessary, got the program down from 5 months down all the way to 12 weeks, and were still and that because of that, we were able to, by five times over, able to train that many more people. And with that, with these kind of success rates. So that was the version that we wanted to get it out to, all for less than $7,000 a head. So we saved an enormous amount of money, got a lot more people trained as well. But what's really wonderful about this program is the folks that we were working with, specifically folks who were generationally impoverished and people who were in and out of the criminal justice system. To have that kind of employment rate was just crazy, because those are people with significant barriers to employment, as they're structurally called. So that was a really interesting thing for us, because we gave them not just the hard skills of doing ecological restoration, but the soft ones of life skills and job readiness. Because, you know, if you grew up with some with family members who you know, had a job, then you knew things like how to be a team player. You know, knowing when you needed to step up, you know, and take initiative, knowing how you needed to look busy when the boss was around, you know, those type of things that, you know, people laugh about that. But if it's not something that was a part of your experience, how would you know? And that's what would make them often, before they had that kind of training, you know, last hired and first fired, as opposed to they had a chance, a fighting chance, and that's what we gave them. So I'm really proud of that. I did some that might work when I was working on the ground back in Sustainable South Bronx, which is the organization I founded, up until 2008. And after that, you know, I decided to, like, take the show on the road and work in the private sector. And I did some consulting and speaking engagements, a lot of advisory services around the country, and had a really, really good time. Although I have to say, I don't really have the temperament to be a consultant, because I'm just, like, by nature a practitioner, and I want to, like, see things through, and consultants don't always get the ability to do that, unfortunately. You can have the greatest ideas and people will not necessarily take them. So, but that's okay. I stand behind them, and, you know, it's like, whatever. But that's a whole other story. It's like, I'm sort of just going through, like, my whole psychological thing of, like, why I was so unhappy for so long. But anyway, I'm much happier now, because I know exactly what I'm doing, and I'm going to tell you. And it's true. I was so depressed for a while, but I'm not anymore. So, it's just like Majora, inside words, outside words, and I just sometimes do not know the difference.
Majora Carter, an urban revitalization strategist. She spoke at the University of Washington's Kane Hall on January 22nd as part of the Graduate School Lecture Series. You can learn more and hear the whole hour of her talk by going to kuow.org/speakersforum. John O'Brien recorded this talk. I'm Rachel Solomon. KUOW 94.9 Seattle.
More from Majora Carter in a moment. KUOW 94.9.
Some people say they're going to do stuff, but when you look at another person in the eye and vow that it will happen, you've gone to a whole other level. On the next Snap Judgment, from PRX and NPR, The Pact. Snap Judgment, storytelling with a beat. Do not miss it.
Sunday afternoon at 2 o'clock on KUOW 94.9.
Support for KUOW comes from Seattle Good Business Network, presenting the semi-annual Dine Around Seattle, featuring three-course dinners of appetizer, entree, and dessert at over 50 Seattle neighborhood restaurants, Sundays through Thursdays, March 2nd through March 27th. Details at dinearoundseattle.org.
Republican senators have had sharp words for President Obama's handling of the crisis in Ukraine. We'll look at the president's approach to world affairs tonight at midnight.
Support for KUOW comes from Broadway Center, presenting Black Violin, bringing a blend of hip-hop, rock, R&B, classical, and bluegrass in a violin concert, accompanied by their band on Friday, March 7th at 7:30 at Tacoma's Pantages Theater. More at broadwaycenter.org.
Tonight, expect a low temperature in the mid-40s, showers likely, wind up to 18 miles an hour. On Friday, a high in the mid-50s, mostly cloudy, 30% chance of showers in the morning. And Friday night's low around 45, mostly cloudy.
From KUOW 94.9 Seattle, I'm Rachel Solomon. This is Speakers Forum. Majora Carter's motto is Green the Ghetto. Carter is a leader in urban development, and she's spearheaded a number of restoration projects in her neighborhood of the South Bronx. In 2008, she founded the Majora Carter Group to bring her approach to communities in other parts of the country. She focuses on green economy to unlock each city's potential. Carter spoke at the University of Washington's Kane Hall on January 22nd as part of the Graduate School Lecture Series.
So, but it was really great being out and about for all these years because I had this fascinating sort of epiphany, you know, because often I'm taken to the South Bronxes of wherever, you know, and like that's the place that, you know, that I'm called to work with it on. And the thing that struck me the most over all these years was that there's really only two kinds of real estate development in poor communities. There's the kind that assumes that that neighborhood's going to get better. And then what you're going to see, you know, is gentrification is going to happen, displacement's going to happen. The place becomes like this really cute place where, you know, where there were formerly like, you know, black, brown, or poor people, and then there are people who have like little designer dogs and cute cafes pop up and all that kind of stuff. And so that's one kind. And then the other kind is what I like to refer to as poverty level maintenance. So it's the kind of places where you see things like, you know, instead of healthy, affordable food, you'll see things like plenty choices like this. Or, you know, instead of places that you would want to go and get goods and services in, you would leave them just because, like, that how physically appealing is that? And no cheaper than what you can get in another neighborhood. 99-cent stores instead of, like, other types of stores, you know, and even definitely, I mean, it's like I can count, you know, on one big block in my neighborhood, three separate liquor stores. They never seem to go out of business and never seem to close. And also plenty of the, you know, we've got also no places to build financial equity. Plenty of pawn shops and check cashing stores, payday loan places and things of that nature. Depending on which part of the country that you're in, you'll find any or all of those. And then additionally, super huge amounts of very highly subsidized affordable housing, specifically for the poorest of the poor. So you add all of those things together, and what do you get? You get poverty that is concentrated and continues to be concentrated, because nobody else is going to live in a place like that except the uber poor. And then we wonder why all the social ills associated with it, you know, are exacerbated, you know, from health disparities to low educational attainment to, you know, environmental burdens being placed in communities like this, to obviously poverty and even incarceration, all concentrated in places like this. And I started thinking about, well, like, my goodness, was there a time when there was a place where there was, you know, something in between those two polar opposites? You know, where, you know, there was like something in the middle where there was economic diversity happening. And interestingly enough, I started thinking about that the time, you know, the levels of pre-integration, where black folks in many places were legally, they had to stay in poor neighborhoods. So it didn't matter if you happened to have, if you happened to be a lawyer or a doctor, you would, chances are, live within close proximity to a janitor or someone else who was not at that economic range. So you had racial segregation, but you had economic diversity, something that we do not see very much of, you know, in poor communities at all. And I thought, when integration happened, one of the unintended consequences of that was that the ones who could afford to do so left because they could. And you can't quite blame them, you know, to search for greener pastures. You know, that's part of the American dream, isn't it? But what did that mean for the folks that were left behind, where there was a sense of social cohesion, where there was a sense that everybody was in it together because you were in it together, and that there was a sense of you were your brother's keeper, and there was also a sense of aspiration, like you could see things that you could become that you might not be exposed to, whereas in very low income communities right now there is this not just a you know, there's often a feeling that you are born poor, you will stay poor. And, you know, it's one of the saddest things that I experience in my neighborhood sometimes is that if people don't see me walking out of my house, and when they see me, they will say things to me like, "So where do you live, Majora?" And it's not because, you know, they think that I'm better or anything. They do think that I'm better because they see me as a successful person. And they feel that success doesn't live in places like the South Bronx. So therefore, of course, I live someplace else. Like, it is to be expected. In places like the ones that I live in and the ones that I'm dedicated to coming up with a strategy to support, the folks in those communities, the ones that were left behind a generation ago, are taught to measure success by how far they can leave those communities. And I was like, what do we do? How do we deal with the unintended consequences of integration? How do we create a model for economic diversity that actually creates the capacity for the income generators to want to stay in those communities? How do we reduce the brain drain? Because kids like me, you know, the smart ones in a community like mine, you know, we were definitely taught, oh, you're going to go to college and get out of here. And I wasn't the only one. Believe me, there were plenty of smart kids, you know, that went to PS 48 and I 74. They moved to New Jersey. Or I swear they did. Or Long Island or something like that. And we still have these ties to our community, but they didn't stay because, you know what? It's hard to get a cup of coffee or a decent cafe or to find a good place to shop or really good schools for your kids. So, all I could think was, how do we create opportunities and models for real estate development instead of either gentrifying or maintaining poverty? How do we create opportunities that allow real estate development to be used as a platform for social, environmental, and economic transformation? To increase economic diversity in these communities, to develop them into the kind of things that we can all be proud of. And I thought, we can do that if we create opportunities for mixed income housing and mixed use commercial development, that, and the commercial development in particular is designed to help follow the economic trends to help move people out of poverty so there's a diversity of income. And that the poor people aren't, the start, are not always the same poor people. Like, isn't that interesting? So when I looked around at our community, and I realized that this kind of configuration is very common in a lot of post-industrial communities around the country, where you've got the orange part is the residential section, the blue is the industrial, and then there's always this little, like, really weird little hinge area in between and where they kind of connect. But then if you look around, you will always find assets. Like, for example, I didn't even know that we had a waterfront. Well, I knew we had something called the Bronx River because there was a parkway named after it, and I saw it on a subway map, but I'd never been to it, even though I lived right within walking distance from it. But so the waterfront was an asset. We also have great public transportation. So, again, you have to look for the assets, but they are always there. We just sometimes don't see them, especially if we're taught to discount, you know, communities like that. But that little site became intriguing to me, that place where the two parts hinge together, because I thought, could it be possible to use that area as the catalyst for the kind of changes that we think that we can do in urban communities? And so what are some of those things? Well, mixed income housing is one. Yes, definitely affordable housing, you know, for low-income folks, but also affordable housing for people with jobs. You know, the ones that who leave communities like this because they have enough money to go and live someplace else. But how cool would it be if we can create the kind of housing that would attract them to stay? And then also the next thing is looking at what are the economic trends going forward so that we can prepare people to participate in, especially many of the low-income folks, with accessible jobs, with career ladders going forward. And so we identified a couple of those things. One is technology. Because there's some where you need a CS degree or an engineering degree, but there's a whole range of jobs where you don't need either one. You need some training, but that's pretty much it. So identifying things like that, and even in manufacturing the 21st century, no, we're never going to go back to the U.S. steel days, and actually, thank God, we won't. But there's different with the appetite to do outsource as much manufacturing as we once did is, I think we're going to be bringing some of that back, and especially in apparel, different kinds of urban outdoor gear in particular, and also food production. That kind of stuff is definitely going to be coming straight back to cities in really big ways. So that is really important. Public space, how you create excellent public space can help define a community and help them feel completely different about the way they see themselves and the way the world sees them. And they build community, you know, they create opportunities for people just to get together. They can provide opportunities for stormwater management, air quality improvement, all of those wonderful things as it gets people outside to enjoy each other and create a sense of stability that wasn't otherwise there if people are constantly only in their homes. And last but definitely not least, people will leave communities like this when they can for some of what you consider the smallest things. So things like being able to get a decent cup of coffee at a cute cafe, an affordable grocery store that sells decent food, bookstores, bike shops, all those things that I've just mentioned, none of them can you find in my community. Not one. So building out, using real estate as a way to build those things out, which also help to circulate dollars within a community, because traditionally dollars only circulate, $1 will circulate one time in a poor neighborhood, whereas you can identify the economic health of a community by how many times it circulates. You know, an economically healthy community, it can go up to like 16 times before that dollar leaves, because people will spend it at the grocery store, and the grocery store person will send it to the dry cleaners, and it goes all the way back and forth. And that's the way you want it to be. Those provide, you know, a sense of jobs, but also community ownership and investment in the development of that community. Again, builds social cohesion. But on the technology front, one of the things we did many years ago, we worked with MIT and worked with their media lab and found out about this wonderful project called Fab Labs, or short for Fabrication Laboratory. And they're basically 3D printers and rapid prototyping is the thing that you do. But the whole idea here was that, and what Fab Labs do is you link personal computers with fabrication machines, and then once you know the programs, you can pretty much design anything you want, and it comes out the other end of this machine or whatever machine you're working. So rapid prototyping is used for anything from, say, clothing manufacturing to organs for human transplant. And obviously this is the inside of a tricked out NASCAR trailer, so you're not going to create livers out of here. But the point is, you could do something. The idea was, how do you use this as a way to help people see themselves as creators and inventors in their own right, as real producers? And it was an amazing process, because we also wanted to challenge people to look really critically at their community and see what could be used as a resource that could be used within the Fab Lab. And so some really interesting, enterprising young people saw those wooden pallet boxes that often just get chunked up and then incinerated in somebody else's city, unfortunately. When they pull them apart and then lash them together, and ran and just developed a program, you know, to develop it. What they got were these kind of this furniture. So this was a really cool, perfectly legal side hustle, you know, for some of the folks that went through the program. I mean, but this is what it's about. You know, if you could keep somebody, you know, gainfully employed for a while, you keep them out of jail. That's a lot cheaper, and it's much healthier, I think, for all concerned. But now going back to, like, so where's tech going? We are definitely in this multi-platform world. I mean, we want everything to work yesterday on everything. We don't care how old or new our like little appliances are, but that's the whole point. And then we're also moving into this incredibly multi-ethnic, very diverse America. You know, where I'm from, the New York City region, we were no longer a white majority back in 2011. The rest of the country will get there around 2040, you know, according to demographers. And so I think that is absolutely the case. And, you know, and so we're also this country that is becoming, we're like so tech native. So there's this whole idea about digital divides. It's just, especially in poor neighborhoods, it's not about access. It's about it's whether you're a consumer or whether you're a producer of technology. And this picture cracks me up simply because, like, this is, you know, in front of a Mac store downtown. And, you know, look at the folks there. They're mostly black and brown faces, like, waiting for some silly iPhone or something. I'm going back to Android myself, but that's another story. I don't know what the buzz was about that.
Majora Carter, an urban revitalization strategist. She spoke at the University of Washington's Kane Hall on January 22nd as part of the Graduate School Lecture Series. You can learn more and hear the whole hour of her talk by going to kuow.org/speakersforum. John O'Brien recorded this talk. I'm Rachel Solomon, KUOW 94.9, Seattle.
More from Majora Carter in a moment. KUOW 94.9, News and Information.
America's a melting pot of musical styles, but singer and piano man Alan Toussaint says his native New Orleans has a flavor unlike any other.
Fortunately, America has many pits of music that they can claim. It's just that I feel that ours is the strongest.
New Orleans legend Alan Toussaint, this week on Sound Opinions.
You can hear that Sunday night at 10 p.m. on KUOW 94.9.
Support for KUOW comes from North Seattle Community College, where students earn short-term certificates, train for a new career, or prepare to transfer to a four-year university. And new this year, offering evening associate degree programs. Enrolling now for spring quarter. More at northseattle.edu.
It's easy to find out what's on KUOW. You can do it at KUOW.org. Just click on Weekly Schedule to get a complete rundown of our programs.
Support for KUOW comes from the Snoqualmie Indian Tribe. Known as the People of the Moon, Snoqualmie tribal members were signatories of the Treaty of Point Elliott in 1855. More about the tribe's charitable donations, programs, and services at snoqualmietribe.us.
Expecting a low tonight around 45 degrees, showers likely, and wind up to 18 miles an hour. It's 9:44.
From KUOW 94.9 Seattle, I'm Rachel Solomon. This is Speakers Forum. Majora Carter is an urban revitalization strategist who examines the connection between urbanization and the environment. She spoke at the University of Washington's Kane Hall on January 22nd, as part of the Graduate School Lecture Series.
We're also, you know, obviously present company not included, but the point is, America has absolutely lost its educational power and dominance. So we've got a whole bunch of, like a whole slew of young people and older people who are going to have a hard time, you know, getting themselves employed. So here we've got, you know, a place that's moving into more of the, you know, of the tech economy, and then we've got, you know, a series of fairly under educated folks and underprepared in that regard, and a community and a whole country that's becoming even more diverse. We really have to figure out ways to develop very, very much appropriate economic development that's going to help, you know, allow us to move into the 21st century well. So one of the things that we started was a project called Startup Box South Bronx, and it's a technology, education, and entrepreneurship program that's designed to pull people into the tech economy from low-income communities so that they can move from being straight-up consumers into being producers of technology. And so that, like many other revolutions booms, that they won't leave us behind. So one of the things that we've been really interested in working on, especially now when we think about it, because, you know, I think the tech world has already changed everything about how we communicate with each other, and it's going to be important that we've got a lot of different voices at the table to make sure that we can continue to do that, you know, going forward. So one of the first things that we did was we did do a youth education component, where we went into the local schools, and into one local school, because it was hard getting, Lord knows, it was hard getting into schools, even though we were giving a free program, because they were teaching the tests, and at the time, people were not thinking that black and brown kids should be coding. You know, we went in, taught them to code, and within a couple of days, there were kids who were creating their own video games that they put up on Google Play. These were 14 and 15-year-old kids, which was really very exciting. That whole digital native thing is just killing me. I just love it. But it was really exciting to see that. But the other thing, going back to the whole jobs piece within the tech economy and trying to figure out, like, well, where are the jobs? And fortunately for us, one of our advisors is the head of games development at Nickelodeon. And he was like, in tech services. Right now, we outsource an enormous amount of it, and in particular in quality assurance. So in games or in most software, somebody develops a game, which is all, or a piece of software, and that's all fine and dandy, and then someone does the quality assurance on it to check and see how, in fact, does this work. And the whole idea around that is really simply, you know, you've got to understand how a game works in order to make sure it works correctly. And so you get to sort of see how it's engineered, and it's also a fantastic sort of entry-level job into the world of different kinds of software development. The head of Electronic Arts, one of the biggest game developers in the world, I believe, it's bigger than most film studios combined, and the head of that company started as a QA tester. So that's a career path, so which we kind of dig. So last summer, we did a pilot program with Nickelodeon where we got kids, a couple just graduated out of high school. One actually did have a CS degree, and one had to drop out of college for financial reasons. Work with them to do this quality assurance program, and we had to do a pilot because since most of the stuff is outsourced, to near source it was a big deal. Even though the cultural vernacular, being in the same time zone, there were plenty of reasons why we knew this thing would work, especially considering you didn't have to have a huge amount of training going into this in order to do the job well. But of course, you know, the folks did pass with flying colors and just created a tremendous volume of quality work that they were so pleased with. We're moving forward into the more experimental phases, getting on some more clients, so that we, you know, hopefully by the end of this year, will be considered like the go-to subcontractor for QA in New York City. And we think that model can, you know, in terms of tech services and other types of tech services, will be something that we could translate in other communities, you know, poor communities around the country, so that tech centers can exist beyond just, you know, the established places where tech should grow, and that there are going to be different sections and that will work to support and other communities and people within it, again, providing levels of opportunity there into those kind of places as well. So we're very excited about it. And, yeah, these are some old numbers, you know, in terms of where the money's at. And, again, this number is just going through the roof as we go forward, which we're very excited about. But, again, to think about, you know, location, 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 and how do we use real estate development as this great platform for transformation? This is part of that hinge area that I told you about before. So the left side is a former juvenile detention facility that the city's going to put up for redevelopment. And we're absolutely going to be competing for that, you know, to redevelop that site. And it's a big site, about almost 6 acres, you know, for the kind of mixed income housing and mixed use commercial development that we think is going to be like the most transformational use of that property. But this is such a really interesting kind of site, because what you have here is, I think, the perfect manifestation of like that idea that the weirdness that happens when the industrial and the residential area meets. So on one side, you had a former jail. On the other side is just like, you know, some fairly empty parking lots, a truck engine rebuilding lot, an illegal chop shop. But, you know, but really what that place is known for at night when all those things do close down is because it's so lonely and so desolate and nothing really happens there, it's known as a great place for a trucker to go and pick up a prostitute. So again, not exactly the kind of use that you really want to see happening in your own community. However, think about what the community would, how would they respond to this kind of stuff, where you've got a kind of very positive, active, floor plane happening, you know, with shops and community just hanging out and doing things in a positive way because you kind of have to in a place like this. So economic diversity, you know, just fun, vibrant things happening in ways that are really important. And so the idea here is just that the kind of development that we want to see happen is not at all about, you know, just creating a nice little project. It's about raising the bar for what passes for economic development all over the place. And we're really interested in seeing this happen by the approach that we're using is one that's all about, you know, retaining and supporting folks within the local community. So right now we know that there are folks that, you know, have made investments in the community and have been there through the tough times in our communities. We're not interested as real estate developers going in and buying up their property as speculators. It's more like, no, you've been here, you've made investments in the community, you stuck it out, you know, during all the eras of urban blight. We want you to stay exactly where you are and join with us and partner with us, you know, as a partner to do this economic development so that you retain your right to this property. It is your property. But you also retain your right to participate in the development that happens on it, that it will be a mix of these things that will pay you back and your family back generations to come. So it's not just let's speculate you out and gentrify you out. It's more like how do we partner in the redevelopment of our community that brings these regenerative aspects to us for us to benefit from. It's like we become our own gentrifiers. And that's harnessing that power because, you know, we want to create opportunities for people to benefit as the community gets better because poor people like nice things too. They want their neighborhoods to be good. They want to, you know, have safe places to shop. You know, they want their schools to be good. They want healthy places to walk around and to live in. I mean, that's just human nature. It's not something that only rich people want. So why don't we create these models that allow folks in these communities to participate in the economic benefits that you know are coming? But without creating a model that includes them, they will be excluded. So we're very excited about seeing that kind of thing happen and bringing it back to our local community. And to start there, you know, again, it's all about how do you create new models that just make sure that people see value in the community as it is, and so that we can be prepared for all of that kind of that transformation coming down the pipe. This is actually going to be our first project. This is a former rail station. Amtrak owned it. They stopped rail service there many, many years ago and sort of and portioned it out as a bit of a strip mall. So it was a pizza shop, actually. Literally a strip club in it, sort of annoying. But the nice thing was is they, when they evicted all the tenants, and what this wasn't nice, I'm sorry. What they did do, they got tired of being a landlord, evicted all the tenants, and shuttered the building. And it was just like, this is literally the gateway into the Hunts Point community, into my neighborhood. My office is literally directly across the street from it, and I live around the corner. But you get off the subway, you cross, you know, the service road from the highway, and then that's the first thing you see. And so for me, who grew up when a good portion of the South Bronx had burned down and most of the build and most of the businesses were gone, to see something like that when I walked to work was just like, oh, no, 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 we're not going back there. So I got Amtrak to work with me, and we're going to acquire that building and develop it into a lifestyle destination for the community that will include a cafe and a spa. You know, the kind of things that people leave the neighborhood to experience right now. But first, we had to do something about the way it looked immediately. So we did this mural on it by hiring some local kids from the neighborhood to work with us on it. And we did that. And there was a very strategic reason why we did that, because we wanted to help young people who are often just considered nothing but problems in the neighborhood to be a part of the transformation as it went forward, and to also help them see an economic reason for being a part of it too. So, I mean, for a relatively small investment, it was really incredible to watch these young people see themselves, you know, as real agents of change, and to take a project from an idea straight to fruition. So they had to assess the situation itself, and then they worked with a professional artist, the lovely Chris Beck, you know, who helped them design a project that they could complete within a set amount of time, and then they executed. And so for people in the neighborhood to see this group of young people working on this great big old canvas, it was a really tremendous opportunity for them to feel as though they were creating real change for themselves in the neighborhood, but also for other folks to see that the change was happening. So we are still very much in our real estate projects. We are very, very much in our starting to launch the beta version. And we're getting our, you know, and it's sort of like the weird mix of angel investment at the same time. But to go from something that looks like this to this, in the long-term hopes of getting to something like this, is that is the goal and a way that we can help continue to make this thing move forward. So this is one of my absolute favorite quotes in the world for a number of reasons. I mean, when I think it was written, it was Dr. King wrote it when he was in the Birmingham jail. You know, it was a group of white ministers who wrote this long letter, you know, open letter to him about, you know, sort of stopping a hold on this equality stuff. And this was part of his response, which I think really speaks volumes to the idea that there does need to be a way to move transformation forward quickly, because we have to do it because people's lives are depending on it. And even though I know, you know, my friend Bill Clinton will say things like, you know, there will never be a time when there won't be a distance between where we are and where we want to be and where we ought to be. But the point is, we need to go quickly to where that place is, and we have to be urgent about moving that forward, because we have spent so much time, you know, building, you know, collectively, you know, tributes to all the things that we know are wrong with this world. And we, each and every one of us, have the capacity to build enormous monuments to the hope and possibility that will change this world and make life better for each and every one of us. So we need to get busy on that, and I'm really excited to know that we're all a part of doing that together. So thank you very much for having me.
Majora Carter, an urban revitalization strategist. She spoke at the University of Washington's Kane Hall on January 22nd as part of the Graduate School Lecture Series. You can learn more and hear the whole hour of her talk by going to kuow.org/speakersforum. John O'Brien recorded this talk. I'm Rachel Solomon, KUOW 94.9, Seattle.
KUOW 94.9 News and Information. I'm Jack Walters, in for Bill O'Grady. Thanks for being with us.
So we started dating, and I told my friends about the relationship, and they were really shocked. They told me things like, you can't be gay, you've never had a girlfriend before, you can't be gay, you've always dated boys. And my favorite, which I still get, is, you can't be gay, you don't look gay at all.
Join us next time for the Moth Radio Hour, True Stories Told Live. From the Public Radio Exchange, PRX.org.
You can hear that Sunday afternoon on KUOW 94.9.
Support for KUOW comes from Pacific Continental Bank, working to strengthen communities by helping businesses and nonprofits succeed. Learn more at therightbank.com. Pacific Continental Bank, focused on business, passionate about community.
KUOW FM Seattle, KUOW Tumwater, KQOW Bellingham, and Digital HD Services.
Hi, this is Jack Spear.
Every day, KUOW and NPR bring you news and information that reflect the world and keep you connected. Your financial support is what makes it all possible. Right now, your support will help give the upcoming spring membership drive a head start so we can get you back to regular programming sooner. Please mail in your gift or pledge online today at KUOW.org. And thank you.
News headlines coming up in 1 minute. It's 10 o'clock.
Thanks for listening. The program you just heard was made possible by the financial support of our listeners. Support this program and others like it by making a pledge today at KUOW.org.